Hey, it's The Takeaway on December 23rd. I'm WNYC's Shamita Basu in for Tanzina Vega. Today on the podcast, 1 year after the passage of a bipartisan Criminal Justice Reform Act, a look at what the measure has achieved.
And I think the First Step Act actually opened the door and the eyes of many people for those who are incarcerated and formerly incarcerated.
Plus, with Christmas just days away, we'll hear how non-Christians in the United States are celebrating at this time of the year in their own ways.
Putting the hijab on a Christmas tree proves that we are one. And this solidarity and this kindness and this love is, in a way, a form of a little resistance in itself.
And why some LGBTQ fans have a bad feeling about a brief moment of queer representation in the new Star Wars.
It makes them get to seem progressive without actually having to be progressive. And that's kind of the way that they play their publicity game.
All right, let's get into it. We start with the First Step Act. One year ago, President Trump passed a law that promised criminal justice reform across the country.
We call it the First Step Act. I sort of like the idea of just calling it criminal justice reform.
The bipartisan First Step Act authorized the early release of federal prisoners who were convicted of low-level drug offenses and have worked through rehabilitation programs. And 1 year later, more than 3,000 inmates have been released. One of them is Nora Yahya.
I did 10 years in Danbury FCI and then lowered my security level to the camp. And from there, I was released upon the FSA, which put me out March 11, 2019, which took off approximately 3 years of my sentence.
Nora was in for possession and intent to distribute cocaine.
I think one of the excitements of the First Step Act is that people could get closer to their families and continue that bond.
For Nora, besides being away from her children, incarceration meant enduring painful health issues with no relief.
While I was incarcerated, my legs start hurting me, and I also had lymphoma, like two lumps in my legs. So one night, I actually couldn't even get up. They actually had to call the ambulance.
But it was only after her release this year that she was finally able to undergo back surgery.
It completely changed all the pain in my legs. I feel like 100% like the person I was prior to all that happening.
Even after the long overdue medical treatment, for Nora, re-entry was challenging.
It was very hard, not just technology-wise. That's something in its own self that was hard and very challenging. I also started out in a new state, which is New York, but I had to start over with my children who aren't children, who are adults now.
But the First Step Act led her to criminal justice reform organizations that helped guide her post-incarceration life.
They introduced me to a computer program there, which is just the basics of surfing the internet, things that are just totally foreign to me. They also helped me with my medical assistance because I hadn't had the proper medical treatment. And I also took a program to become licensed for a food handler.
Now, Nora works as an advocate for people who are incarcerated.
And I think the First Step Act actually opened the door and the eyes of many people for those who are incarcerated and formerly incarcerated.
For more on the First Step Act and where it is 1 year in, I'm joined by Jonathan Terry, policy advisor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and Lewis L. Reed, national organizer for Cut 50, a bipartisan initiative to cut crime and incarceration in half across the country. Thanks to both of you for being here on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Jonathan, first, tell us how the First Step Act is intended to work when it comes to early release.
So the First Step Act includes several provisions for federal prison reform. It eliminates the three-strike rule, which is a law that was originally meant to provide harsher punishments for those who have several federal convictions. So previously, you could get a life sentence for having three convictions, federal convictions. Mm-hmm. That's been reduced to a 25-year sentence. It also extends the 2010 Fair Sentencing Act, which reduced the disparity that could be given in a sentence for selling crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. It also brings people closer to home, ideally. 500 miles is now the limit that people are supposed to be allowed to be away from home when in a federal prison. It includes a lot of other quality of life, you might say, provisions for federal prisons as well. So women who are pregnant are no longer able to be shackled. Juveniles are no longer able to be put in solitary confinement. It also expanded reentry programs, which was mentioned a little bit before. So the process of going back into society after prison is an arduous one. And so the First Step Act apportioned millions of dollars for a lot of those programs to help mm-hmm. people as they reenter. It was also meant to create risk assessment tools, which look at someone's record and various other factors to decide whether or not they are a risk to society. And that way, ideally, we are able to look at people, allow them to exit from prison and know, because this person isn't going to be a risk to anyone, we feel okay letting them out even potentially earlier.
Let me ask you about sentence reduction, because as I mentioned just a minute ago, more than 3,000 people have been released now under this act. Can you explain what the process looks like for them to have gotten their sentences reduced?
Right. So a lot of the people who are having their sentences reduced were originally sentenced in the 70s and 80s as a part of the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the First Step Act says that since we sentence people differently now, we are going to look at those sentences that were given before, and if they are no longer in line with what we would sentence you currently, we are going to reduce those sentences. Many of them, those sentences are reduced through petition. Some are reduced automatically. There is also an expansion of good time, which says that if you are incarcerated but you are taking part in programs that are meant to rehabilitate you, whether that's job training or drug treatment or something of that sort, you can have time taken off of your sentence. And so there are different provisions to allow people to reduce their sentences. And about 1,700 people have gotten reductions in their sentence since the First Step Act went into law. And there's a reduction of about 6 years on average for people who have that reduction.
Lewis, let me bring you into the conversation. Jonathan just mentioned the war on drugs in the 70s and 80s. This act is mainly aimed at people who were arrested during that time period. Many of them were Black men. What do we know about the demographics of the people who've been released under the act so far?
You know, for decades, the criminal justice conversation among our political leaders, especially both on the state and national level, could be characterized as a race to the bottom. It was a competition for who could be the toughest on crime, who could lock up the most people and throw away the key. It was also a conversation that was defined by dangerous rhetoric with no regard for empathy or second chances. And, you know, essentially it dehumanized people. I was one of those individuals that was in that conversation. In 2000, I was sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 188 months. And for our listening audience, I don't want to, you know, belabor the point in terms of you using your fingers and toes trying to figure that out. That's approximately 16 years. I served almost 14 years off that 16-year federal prison sentence for white-collar related offenses. Most of the individuals by whom I was incarcerated with were not individuals that had got caught up in the war on drugs in the 70s and 80s. In fact, these individuals were caught up in the mid-90s to the early 2000s, especially after the 1994 Clinton crime bill. 91% of the individuals that were released under that particular provision that Jonathan talked about, as it relates to the crack cocaine provision, 91% of those individuals were African Americans. So let me just quantify these numbers for you for a second. To date, 7,000 people total have been released under the First Step Act. I should say 7,000 people total have received significant reductions, and they have been released under the First Step Act. 91% of those individuals happen to be African Americans who were sentenced under those draconian, crack cocaine laws, particularly pointing back to 1987, moving up to 1994, and up to date until about approximately 2010. That has totaled That 7,000 number that has totaled approximately 17,000 years of human freedom that have been restored back to our community. Now, think about this. In the Christmas season, Jesus was crucified approximately 2,000 years ago. And if we look at the numbers, that actually places us back into BC. So I think that this is something that is significant. I am literally pulled over on the side of the road, 20 minutes away from MDC Brooklyn, where I am going to be with a family who is going to have their loved one returned back to them in this Christmas season after having served 20 years on a life sentence, and that individual is going to be released as a result of the First Step Act, and that's as a result of the advocacy with people such as myself, Topeka K. Sam, David Savavian, you know, Cut 50's co-founder Van Jones and Jessica Jackson, and the many other advocates and organizations that was in this bipartisan coalition to make sure that we got this bill across the finish line.
Lewis, let me ask you something, because one of the act's major provisions, as Jonathan mentioned earlier, was to place incarcerated individuals within a 500-mile radius of their families so they would be closer to them. Why was that such an important part of this legislation?
Yeah, so the reason why the 500-mile provision is significantly important within the First Step Act is because it does one of several things. Number one, it makes sure that individuals are connected with their families and that those relationships are cultivated between parents and their children. Number two, it brings about a level of proximity to the individual who was incarcerated and also to their community. And number three, it actually reduces the probability of individuals who are incarcerated from participating in issues that very well could bring about institutional infractions. So for instance, if an individual is in proximity to their last known address and they know that they are potentially going to see their mother, their father, their family members, significant others, et cetera, they are going to be less likely to be engaged in fights, assaults, you know, and the likes thereof.
Jonathan, the act, when it was passed last year, it was hailed by President Trump as a huge achievement in being able to bring the two parties together. As Lewis mentioned, it was largely a bipartisan effort. Why did this act appeal to politicians on both sides of the aisle?
So criminal justice reform brings people together in part because there's a strong moral push for it. It's hard to argue in a lot of cases that someone who may have made a mistake should be put away for such a long time. It's also incredibly expensive. We spend billions of dollars incarcerating people.
Especially here in the United States, we have the world's largest prison population.
We do. We have over 2.1 million people in prison in the United States. And I think that regardless of where you fall politically, you can see that we are wasting a lot of money on putting people in cages when those people could be contributing to the economy. Those people could be with their families. And so it really brings people together on either side. And of course, Jared Kushner is a father who was incarcerated, and so he understands some of the issues that are being that are at play here, and he was able to help usher along the political coalition that pushed through the First Step Act. And I think that we are also thinking a lot about mass incarceration. The fact that we do have so many people put away, the draconian laws that were just mentioned have really torn apart communities, and we're able to now fight that together, and I think everyone can see the value in that.
Lewis, I know that you're very involved in communities where people are returning home from prison. Can you talk about some of the biggest hurdles for them once they're out?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there are things that, you know, are obvious and show up in the stat sheets. You know, these are the things in terms of employment, housing insecurities, et cetera, and the likes thereof. I think that one of the major issues that this First Step Act seeks to remedy is the simplicities of things such as not having an identification card. One of the provisions within the bill actually requires all federal people who are being released to make sure that they have access to appropriate identification. When you think about that, that may not necessarily seem like much, quote unquote, much. But when you think about how an individual could potentially have incidental contact with police, with law enforcement, and that individual could potentially have their term of supervision violated because of incidental contact, because he or she may be in a place where they may be accosted by the police. They could be riding in as a passenger in a vehicle. An officer asks for that individual's identification. That individual can't produce it because he or she has not necessarily secured it, because you need an ID just to get an ID, and all the bureaucracy involved with that. That individual could actually be hauled into their local police department just to check out who they are, and when they are there, that could potentially trigger a violation for police contact. So there are things in terms of like employment. Yes, people need to be back, not even back, because most of the individuals who are actually incarcerated, they may not necessarily have had employment in the first place. So they need to enter into our workforce. They need to make sure that they have adequate housing. They need to make sure that they have access to appropriate health care, treatment, et cetera. And so one of the things that we're doing at Cut 50 is one of the several following. We have partnered with Lyft through our relationship with Kim Kardashian. They have given us 10,000 free Lyft rideshare credits that we are distributing to individuals who are being released under the First Step Act, so that they can have access to, employment opportunities, healthcare opportunities, et cetera, healthcare appointments, et cetera, I should say. In addition, we have also partnered with Talkspace. Talkspace is the online therapeutic platform, so that individuals can decompress from what I call the new PTSD, and that's prison traumatic stress disorder, so that they can have a safe place just to talk about the traumas or the vicarious trauma that they have actually observed as a result of being incarcerated.
Let me bring Jonathan back in here for just a moment, because this law, I should mention, affects people incarcerated at the federal level. It doesn't even touch the roughly 1.3 million people in state prisons. Are we seeing similar reform movements at the state level, Jonathan?
The federal system incarcerates more than any individual state system, but the state systems account for the vast majority of people in prison. So the federal system is about 10% of the total U.S. Prison population. And so we are seeing some of these reforms being put in place. Not all of them are prison reforms. Some of them are broader criminal justice reforms. But where they are being put in place really depends on the state. New York has just passed new bail laws, which are going to affect shortly, in 2020.
In the new year.
And other places are thinking about, legalizing marijuana, or thinking about how do we safely erase past convictions. And some of that is happening through advocates. Some of it is happening through progressive district attorneys. And so at the state level, not only do you have more people incarcerated, but you have in some ways a more complicated system, just because so many different actors are involved in making particular decisions. And so we do see these reforms, but it'll be harder to push through in a lot of ways on the state level, just to get everyone on board.
And let's talk about politics now on the federal level, because many advocates have acknowledged that the First Step Act is a major victory. But they've also mentioned that the next step is focusing on those who've been found guilty of violent offenses, and perhaps even rethinking policing on a grander scale. Would either of those approaches be able to gain bipartisan support, in your opinion, Jonathan?
That's really hard to say. A lot of previous bills that were not able to be passed lost a lot of support because they pushed too far. A lot of advocates say that the First Step Act didn't go far enough, because it doesn't eliminate mandatory minimums, because it doesn't push far enough on good time credits. We are wondering about what does electronic monitoring do? There is a new thought within criminal justice reform circles that we are moving towards e-carceration, where people's information will be collected and where we'll know where someone is at all times. We'll have a certain amount of information built up, which is a different kind of captivity in a way. And so there are a lot of sort of fights that are yet to be had, but violent crime in particular is a really difficult one, I think, even for people on the left who have been pushing for various kinds of criminal justice reform for years. Thinking about releasing someone who, you know, may have sold drugs at some point is very different from thinking about what do we do with someone who might have hurt someone on the street, may have even killed someone. And so those will be much harder battles, and I, at this point, can't quite see it receiving bipartisan support. But I think that the First Step Act was fantastic because it showed that there is some possibility. I was once told doing this work that if you don't believe that you can make a difference and push forward, then why are you doing the work at all? So I'll stay optimistic.
Jonathan Terry is a policy advisor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and Lewis L. Reed is a national organizer for Cut 50. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Hi everyone, I'm Shamita Basu from WNYC, filling in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Christmas is almost here, but I'm sure I didn't have to tell you that. Christmas music has been playing in stores since November. Colorful Christmas lights have been up for weeks, and commercials featuring Santa Claus seem to be on a never-ending loop. But there are millions of people in this country who don't celebrate Christmas, at least not in the traditional sense. We asked you how you celebrate the season in your own way.
Here's the story of why we put a hijab on our Christmas tree.
That's Isabella, a New Yorker who happens to be the roommate of Takeaway associate producer Jivika Verma. This year, she has chosen to decorate her Christmas tree with a hijab.
It's kind of funny because growing up, I did celebrate Christmas in a way, but not necessarily religiously, more so culturally. I grew up in a mixed household of Christian Pakistani Muslim beliefs, and my dad never felt completely comfortable being from Pakistan, not celebrating Christmas himself growing up. Never felt comfortable giving presents or decorating the tree, but did so for solidarity of my mother.
Now Isabella lives in a household with other people from the South Asian diaspora, and with political turbulence around the world and especially hostility toward Muslims, she says placing the hijab on the tree demonstrates two things: pride in her upbringing and a kind of solidarity.
So something as simple as putting a hijab on a Christmas tree when everything else is happening all over the globe with the South Asian diaspora trying to disconnect us, trying to separate us, prove that we are different. This putting a hijab on a Christmas tree proves that we are one. And this solidarity and this kindness and this love is, in a way, a form of a little resistance in itself.
All right, so we invited you to tell us how you put your own twist on Christmas, and here's what you shared with us.
Hi, I'm Zach from Portland, Oregon. As a child of divorce, I celebrate Hanukkah and Christmas. For the side of my family that celebrates Hanukkah, I feel like American culture has put an emphasis on gift-giving, but maybe with a spin. While my mom and I exchange a Hanukkah gift and meal every year, my dog got 12 Hanukkah gifts last year.
My name is Colette O'Connor, and I'm from Halifax, Massachusetts. We celebrate Christmas at my home. During the day, we make sure to call all the relatives who can't be here so everyone is thought of. And the remaining day is for sharing gratitude, which we do with a quiet meal together and conversation.
This is Nina Duell from Richmond, California. My reaction to Christmas is unsettled. I do not feel like there's acknowledgement of other people celebrating other things. We're just bombarded with red and white and Christmas trees.
Hi, this is Rick DeMays from Needham, Massachusetts. We enjoy the trappings of Christmas, but we do try to emphasize the significance of the holiday from the religious aspect.
This is Bill in New Jersey. What we do this time of year is something called Friendsmas. It's a lot like Friendsgiving. It's a multicultural winter activity that's specifically non-religious. Basically, it's a night of fun. It's a night of multinational and multi-ethnic foods, and it's time to play games and hang out with the people that you really love.
Thanks for sharing all of your thoughts. I'll share with you now my spin on the holiday. This is my first married Christmas. My husband and I did the thing a few months ago in a non-denominational ceremony. And I was raised in a house that didn't really celebrate Christmas. My dad is Indian and my mom is Iranian. Now, my husband, coming from an Italian family, was and is really big on Christmas. So this year, I added a little flair to our Christmas tree. I strung up our red, gold, and white Indian garlands, the garlands that we exchanged as part of our wedding celebration. I think they make a very fitting addition to our tree this year, and I imagine for years to come. Now remember, you can always give us a call and share your thoughts at 8778-MY-TAKE. Now we'll look at other ways that the Christmas creep influences the whole month of December, namely its impact on another religious holiday. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Days of love, days are eight, days of Hanukkah.
Here to help us understand the history of how Christmas shaped Hanukkah celebrations in America, we're joined by two guests. Emma Green is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. Emma, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much.
And Jonathan Sarna is a professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
A joy to be with you.
Jonathan, many people assume that Hanukkah is one of the most important holidays in Judaism because of its strong cultural presence in the United States, but that's not exactly true, right?
Not exactly true. In early America, you would have a hard time finding much evidence that Jews talked about Hanukkah. The high holidays are important. Passover is very important. Hanukkah really emerges in the 19th century. They talk about, in the 1870s, the revival of the Jewish national holiday of Hanukkah. And gift-giving actually shifts from another holiday, known as Purim, to Hanukkah. And then, of course, Hanukkah is magnified through the 20th century in response to the magnification of Christmas.
And let me let Emma cut in there, because you've written about this as well. Why did Hanukkah become the Jewish response to Christmas in the United States?
You see, in the middle of the 20th century, after the war, when Jews are moving to the suburbs, they're starting these synagogues and trying to join country clubs, and in general have the American experience that we think of so stereotypically in the 1950s. And I think we see that today, where Hanukkah has now been elevated to be kind of the equal and opposite reaction to Christmas, something to give Jewish children a feeling that they can fit in just like the Christian children who are celebrating Christmas at their schools.
How were those efforts met in the United States?
It was common to find Jews. Even Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis had a Christmas tree, and lots of Jews sang secular Christmas carols. It's not surprising that some of those carols were really written by Jews like Irving Berlin, about a white Christmas, the feel of the lights, and so on. But the East European Jews, some of whom had very negative associations with Christmas in the lands that they came from, remembering that these were days when they were frightened and persecuted, they certainly were not going to take on Christmas. And as we move through the 20th century, we see Hanukkah arising as a kind of Jewish answer to Christmas. Indeed, there were some Jews who tried to tell their children, oh, you're so lucky. Hanukkah is 8 days of gifts. But the sense was, let's have something that distinguishes us
Emma sitting across from me and nodding her head here. How was Hanukkah celebrated before it started to grow in popularity here in the U.S. as a response to Christmas?
Well, one of the interesting things about Hanukkah religiously is that it actually doesn't have that much of a starring role in the Jewish calendar. There aren't that many obligations that go with Hanukkah, and you don't have to spend that much time in synagogue, especially relative to Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah. What's interesting to me about Hanukkah is that it has been able to take this outsized role in the American public imagination, in part because Jews were free to go out and celebrate publicly. They could take their menorah to a friend's house or have friends over to light the candles. But it's also because it's kind of a low-key holiday, and so there's a lot of freedom and flexibility about how people celebrate.
Jonathan, maybe you can talk to us a little bit more about efforts by Jews in the United States early on to adopt Christmas as a secular holiday. Do you think that Hanukkah could become secular in a similar way?
I think that there are many Jews who observe Hanukkah who do not view it as having deep religious content, might even have a hard time talking much about its history. And in that sense, it has grown secularized. But at the same time, I'm very struck by how recent it is that Hanukkah did move into the public square. As late as the 1950s, store windows did not have Hanukkah, even in New York, and you didn't see menorahs out on the streets. That's really a development that begins in the 1970s with the Chabad religious organization, and they actually have several court cases in which they have to fight for the right to have a Hanukkah menorah in the public square. That right is eventually confirmed by the Supreme Court, which really says that the Hanukkah menorah is in a way equivalent, legally speaking, to the Christmas tree. If one can be in the public square, the other can be in the public square.
In fact, Jonathan, I want to jump in here because Emma wrote about this decision, and you found actually that the Supreme Court treated Christmas trees in public a little bit differently than menorahs in public. Is that right?
Well, one of the questions that was at stake here, and there have been a series of cases about this issue, is whether something like the nativity scene, which we see in all sorts of public spaces, is the equivalent of the menorah, whether that can be in a government building or a government-owned park. And there's a sort of differentiation here that the court uses or that legal thinking uses, which is to say there's a difference between some sort of overtly religious symbol that seems to be an expression of what the government believes or supports versus these communal symbols that we now see ubiquitously even at, you know, a courthouse building or at a government administrative building. You see that kind of equality and equal weight given to something that shows a public expression of what these various groups in the United States celebrated this time.
I feel like there's a lot of hand-wringing over the commercialization of the holidays, whether that's Christmas or Hanukkah. How would you say that gift-giving has or has ever been part of the tradition of Hanukkah?
One universal principle that I think guides Christmas and Hanukkah and maybe even holiday celebrations around this time for families that don't celebrate those two holidays is that we love consumer capitalism here in the United States. And right now, at this season, we see from every corner, stores and malls, everyone trying to incentivize more and more gift giving. And this is something that's lamented seasonally. Everyone trying to say, oh, these holidays should have a deeper meaning about family or about faith, not about gift giving. But really, in American culture, we see that this all-consuming force, this incentive to buy stuff, especially for your kids, has been able to take over these holidays. So in some ways, even though Hanukkah has been set apart as a separate holiday for separate people, there really is a lot that's overlapping about Hanukkah and Christmas.
We've been talking mainly about what happens when Jewish populations from other parts of the world first came to America and were attempting to assimilate. But are there other examples of people from other religions, other faiths, coming to America and sort of adapting their practices to the American Christmas culture, Jonathan?
Another example of this is what we've seen with Diwali, a festival of lights, celebrated in this season of the year. And there are other groups, I think, that have learned from Jews that you can simultaneously be part of the season and apart from it, which is really what I think the Jewish community has tried to do over the last decades.
Emma, I feel like we've spent a lot of this conversation framing this as if only negative things have come out of the Christmasification of other holidays. But what are the positive effects? Is it good for all of us in the U.S. to share celebrations at this time of year?
You know, I think the story of Christmas is a very American story in the sense that, as we've been discussing, it's become a shared celebration that has a lot of secular meaning and takes over our shopping malls and our streets. But it's just as much of an American story to have different groups of people, whether their ancestors came over as Jews in the 19th century, to whether their parents and grandparents are recent immigrants from the 70s or 80s or 90s. And I think that's such an American story because in some ways this is a country that's made up of people who come from all of these different places and traditions and who figure out their own spin on those traditions in the American context. There's so much diversity here around this time of year. You see Orthodox Christians who celebrate Christmas a few weeks later than Roman Catholics or Protestants in much of the United States. You see Muslims who have figured out ways like going bowling or trying to avoid shopping malls of relating to the Christmas celebration. And you have a lot of families who are both families. So both Hanukkah and Christmas, or Christmas and a little something else, or Hanukkah and a little something else. All of these stories, to me, are very much the Americanness of this time of year, people trying to figure out how their particular identity should be in relation to this reason for the season that we call Christmas.
Emma Green is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. And Jonathan Sarna is a professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
This weekend, the third and final installment of the latest Star Wars saga hit theaters. The Rise of Skywalker ties together the previous 8 films in just under 2.5 hours. And in that time, it also managed to squeeze in something that those other films left out, that there are LGBTQ plus people in a galaxy far, far away.
And in the case of the LGBTQ community, you know, it was important to me that people who go to see this movie feel that they're being represented in the film.
That's director J.J. Abrams during an interview with Variety earlier this month. In the lead up to the film's release, he hinted that there would be real LGBTQ representation in The Rise of Skywalker. But when the film premiered last week, it was finally revealed that two minor female characters kiss during a split-second scene. Many are saying it's yet another example of a major Hollywood franchise teasing LGBTQ representation and then not following through in a meaningful way. Joining me now is Kyle Buchanan, a pop culture reporter at The New York Times. Kyle, hi. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Emily Vanderwerf, critic at large for Vox. Emily, hi. Welcome.
It's so great to be here.
Now, I don't want to spoil too much for our listeners who haven't seen the movie, so let's leave plot aside as much as we can. But both of you have seen the movie. Kyle, maybe you can start by telling us about the same-sex kiss scene in the new Star Wars movie and why it's gotten such a big reaction.
Sure, I'd be happy to tell you because I think people who've actually watched the movie, if they blinked, might have missed it. So let me fill them in as well. There is an extremely brief moment in the third act where a character who has had, at that point, maybe two lines, certainly wasn't named, kisses her female partner in a victory celebration of sorts. Goes by extremely fast. And, you know, if that had been a thing that people had seen in 1977, say, when the first Star Wars film came out, it would have been pretty significant. But I think the irony here is that, especially this last film, The Rise of Skywalker, is doing so much to try to satisfy fan demands, but it's not really doing it in a visionary, bold way that would satisfy anybody's asks and requests. And so even though there have been fans who've asked for the characters played by John Boyega and Oscar Isaac to have some sort of romantic relationship in Star Wars, this is sort of the sop to that, and I don't think it's going to satisfy all that many people.
Now, we just heard the director, J.J. Abrams, a few minutes ago. That was him speaking during the press tour for the film. And he mentioned LGBTQ representation. He went out of his way to say it. In fact, there are some critics who have called what he said now a classic example of queerbaiting. Emily, maybe you can explain what that is.
So queerbaiting is the idea that there is some sort of movie or TV show, especially, but it can also happen with books or other forms of fictional media, where two characters who are presented as platonic friends within the text of the show, then fans often become, you know, interested in the idea of them having a romantic relationship. An example of this from these new Star Wars movies would be Finn and Poe, who are not really presented as romantic partners in that first movie, The Force Awakens, but the internet took that and ran with it. And these future movies have sort of played to that in interesting ways. A far more egregious example was the TV show Sherlock, which recently aired with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. And that show, the fans started sort of shipping, which means hoping to see two people end up together, Sherlock and Watson on that show.
Right.
And it did not transpire, and it turned into like the creators sort of baiting those expectations without actually doing anything about it. It can be really kind of a nasty way to deal with your fandom.
Now, to go back to Star Wars for a second and what Abrams said during the press tour, why the fake out? I guess it's easy to assume that dipping an ambiguous toe into LGBTQ representation is meant to appease certain audience who want to see that representation, without going so far as to anger more conservative audiences. How much is it about that dynamic?
It's definitely about that dynamic. Like, there is sort of this air of they're trying to sort of make the right people mad, by which I mean the really extremist people who don't want to see any LGBTQ representation. And like, you know, if there's a 2-second kiss, most of America is going to be like, okay, whatever. But like, they're also not trying to push the envelope in terms of that representation in ways that might force people to sort of rethink their preconceptions or their prejudices or anything like that. It is just like the least risky way to deal with this material, but also in a way that gets them these headlines and, you know, publications that are like, oh, bold new ground for the Star Wars franchise, when you see the movie and it's literally nothing like that. So it makes them get to seem progressive without actually having to be progressive. And that's kind of the way that they play their publicity game.
I want to ask each of you what meaningful representation would look like. GLAAD, the LGBTQ media advocacy organization, uses this metric that they made up. It's sort of similar to the Bechdel test. They call it the Vito Russo test after GLAAD's co-founder. And to pass the Vito Russo test, a film has to have a character that is identifiably LGBTQ. That character must not be solely defined by their sexual orientation or gender identity. And that character must be tied to the plot in such a way that their removal would have a significant effect. So, Emily, why don't you start? Do those criteria sound right to you when we ask what is meaningful representation? Would you add anything to it?
I certainly don't disagree with any of those criteria. I'm happy to have that sort of as a starting point. But I think that, you know, there's room for stories about LGBTQ plus lives, like that are actually about our lived experiences. And it's not like they don't exist. There's plenty of great queer art made every year. It's just that it's not, you know, happening in major studio franchise films. I think if we're looking for a major studio franchise film to tell stories that, you know, fit that sort of GLAAD description, it's not impossible, but it's also like, you know, it's hard to talk about our identities in a nuanced way when aliens are invading the planet or something like that. So I do think there's room for improvement, but a lot of the stuff that we're looking for is often happening in like indie film and television and, you know, stuff that's supported by Patreon, by independent artists.
I think Emily is right, and I think that queer viewers had just sort of gotten used to expecting and looking for that representation elsewhere, which is why it would be a significant new thing to see it in the forum of the, you know, superhero or science fiction spectacular. And I don't think it has to be, you know, as Emily also said, these films don't often stop for very long to consider the, you know, the minutiae of the characters' inner lives, but just the presence, that counts for something. I mean, Avengers Endgame culminates with this finale, this orgiastic finale of dozens upon dozens upon dozens of characters. And, you know, it wouldn't be so hard for just one or maybe a couple of those people to be on the queer spectrum somewhere. That's how life is. And if these movies are drawing from life and then making something superpowered, it just seems like a notable omission for the only times for them to acknowledge that queer people exist is when they shuttle in a character for one scene.
Kyle Buchanan is a pop culture reporter and award season columnist at the New York Times, and Emily Vanderwerf is a critic at large for Vox. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we do want to keep hearing from our LGBTQ listeners on this one. Do you feel represented in any Hollywood franchises? And how could the industry improve on queer representation? Send us a tweet at The Takeaway or write to us on our Facebook page. And if you missed anything from today's show or you just want to listen back again, check out our podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I'm WNYC's Shumitha Basu, feeling very lucky to be in today and tomorrow for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.